You know, in a lot of places, in a lot of businesses, corporations, marketplace functions, there's what is called, yeah, come on, join me. You can join me too, Sharon. Are you supposed to wait? I was supposed to wait. It's only the proper thing. Okay. What do I know about drama? In a lot of companies, there's called a point where there is like a critical interface, it's called. A critical interface. Like you can feel good about the McDonald's Corporation, but really your main concern is that when you walk up to the counter and you interface with that person there who's taking your order and handing you your stuff, that forms the basis of which you understand what McDonald's is all about. And they do a lot of advertising, but when it all comes right down to it, there's a critical interface that has to happen for you to feel good about McDonald's, correct? Now, same thing could be happening, could be said about a hotel or lots of other things. I'd like to just present to you the idea that the drama that you're going to see is the critical interface of what it means to build a church for non-church people. And so I'd like to just say, you watch this drama, and with that backdrop in mind, you kind of judge for yourself how critical this interface is. Well, I'll bet if you give just a few moments thought, you can see why that interchange, that interface is so critical. If you go back to the beginning where Jesus says, here's the plan. You go into all the world and you preach the gospel. You lead people to faith. And once they come to faith, you edify them, you equip them, you build them up. Okay, that's the plan. That's the challenge, that's the charge. That's the Great Commission, correct? Every Christian who believes in the Bible believes in the Great Commission. What we did at Willow Creek in the early days is we said, all right, the Great Commission, as we understand it, is the commission of this church. And we just kind of put it in the terms of we're going to try to turn irreligious people. When Jesus said, go out and preach the gospel, you know, to all nations, to unbelievers, we said we're going to try to turn irreligious people into fully devoted followers of Christ. That's the one sentence mission statement of Willow Creek. To turn irreligious people into fully devoted followers of Christ. And you say, well, what's the big deal? Why would you spend a few minutes talking about that? The big deal is, believe it or not, most churches, this is not statistically verifiable. I mean, I don't have a study on it. It's just my intuitive sense from getting around here and there. Most churches really don't have a real crisp, one-sentence understanding of why they're doing what they're doing. They're just doing last week again this week. And then whatever they're doing this week, they're going to do that again next week. But they really don't. If you stop members, if you stop staff members, if you're walking around saying, okay, you, stand up. What's the one-sentence mission statement of your church? I find very few people could get right up and give it. We've tried really hard at Willow Creek to say, now look, it's important that we all know what we're about, that we all know what hill it is we're trying to take, that we all know why we're rowing together in the same direction. It's because we're trying to fulfill the Great Commission as our mission in the local church of turning irreligious people into fully devoted followers of Christ. Now, there's another slant to this that's important for you to understand. And maybe the best way I can get at it is to give a fuller explanation of something I made reference to in the earlier session. A couple years back, a Harvard Business School professor commissioned a case study on Willow Creek Community Church. And if you know anything about the Harvard Business School, the second year business school students, in the one particular class that I'm referring to, in one semester they do 29 case studies. Almost every case study is that of a multinational corporation, of some sort or another. And right in the middle of these 29 case studies of multinational corporations is this case study on Willow Creek Community Church. So each time it's presented, I go out and I sit in the class as it's being discussed. And then I do a question and answer time with all the students at the end of the class. It's a fascinating deal. So the first time I went out to defend the case study or to interact with the class on it, the professor is out there in the classroom, a high-energy professor, and saying, "Okay, so what do you think of this church? And what's their product? What are they really in business to try to sell, if you will? How do they know if they've achieved their objectives?" And, you know, he was sort of trying to get people to talk about the church and the case study done on it. At one point, he goes up to a very bright young woman and said, So what about the mission of this church?" And she said, "Well, Dr. So-and-so, they say the mission of the church is to turn irreligious people into fully devoted followers of Christ." And he says, "Well, how do you feel about that?" And she said, "Well, I've never known of a church that had a mission statement like that, because it seems to me like what they're trying to do is turn atheists into missionaries. And frankly, Dr. So-and-so, I see this as one hell of a challenge." Now, I'm sitting in the back of the room and it dawns on me. I said, "That's why it's so hard." I mean, it's like a light went on. I said, "I've never looked at it that way." But she's right. That's why what we're doing in this church is so hard. It's really hard, you know. I don't know if you know that yet. You can wander around here and get the idea that it's easy, that it just ministry flows. We have people in conferences who refer to this as Willow World. You know? It's like the world of ministry fantasy and this kind of thing. And I say, work here. Work here. Ask staff members to tell you the truth. It is really, really hard. I don't know many church staffs that work harder than we work. And it beats you up. I mean, it's hard. And sometimes I've had to say, "Why is it so hard?" And some of you have been at it for many years. You know it's hard. Well, I'll give you a nutshell of why it's so hard. The average traditional pastor of the little church on Elman Vine, okay? You know what he's really trying to do? I mean, can we talk again? And this isn't an indictment on anybody. This is just sort of an observation. The average local pastor of lots of little churches isn't really trying to interest atheists in anything. He doesn't give a rip about atheists. They've made their decision. They're going to hell. Let them go. And you know what else is true? The average traditional pastor in a little regular church on the corner, Elm and Vine, does not see his role as taking Christians and turning them into flaming, radical, spiritual champions. You know what the truth is about what a lot of pastors and staffs are doing? They're taking the already convinced and they're combing the sheep wool a little bit and hoping that they'll stay in the pen. They're saying, "Here's sheep, here's a little something to eat. Don't wander away now. Stay in the pen. Be a good little sheep. Because if I start losing sheep, I get in trouble with the boss, the bishop, the headquarters." But they don't really worry about the front half of the equation. They don't really worry about the back half of the equation. They mainly just want to sort of shepherd and keep the sheep in the pen. Okay? So here, we got a bright gal from Harvard who says, "Man, if you're trying to turn atheists into missionaries, you got one heck of a challenge on your hands." And I say, "That's right." Because the whole first half of the equation, steps 1, 2, and 3 of our 7-step philosophy, which I'm going to explain here, this side of the equation, I'll explain them in a second, this is all about
trying to interest the uninterested in something they have no sense of need or interest in. This is going to non-customers who have no intentions of buying and trying to sell them something that they've said, get out of my face, I don't want. Okay? That's not fun. That's like door slam in the face. That's get out of my face. That's get out of my life. And if you do that for a while, you say, maybe I will just get out of everybody's face in life and get back in the middle and comb sheep wool, keep them in the pen. Now, steps 4 through 7, this is not just about patting sheep on the head. This is about saying, all right, sheep, you got to grow up. Do more than graze and lay down. You know? You got to grow up. And I'm going to start training you. Putting this collar on you and running laps around the pen. You know? Feeding you health food. Getting you hooked up with other sheep. Going on missions together outside the pen. Shearing your wool. It's all about that stuff, see? So both sides are really hard. Which is why it's a lot safer to just do it the way it's been done the last 150 years in the Western world. Just come, preach a few sermons, keep the saints happy, and don't get your nose dirty or your hands dirty on either side of the equation. I gotta say, though, when you read the Bible, you can't get away from the fact that God wants us to work the front part of the equation. Here's Jesus out having these kinds of interfaces all the time. Here's Jesus trying to interest the uninterested, trying to build bridges with people who are outside the faith, trying to gain a hearing with the agnostics and the atheists, grieving in his spirit when the rich young ruler spins on his heels and walks away. It really is a heart-wrenching thing to try to bring Christianity to people who don't think they need it. It's heart-wrenching. There's a guy I'm thinking of right now. I have put about, it must be 14 years into him. 14 years. I don't think I've made a dent. Last time I was presenting the gospel at a seeker service, I saw him sitting right over there, back row of this section right here. When he comes to Willow, he wears sunglasses. Okay? And I'm not kidding you, and he's got some health problems now. I was getting to the point where I was presenting Christ, you know, asking people to consider committing their lives to Christ. And I saw him out of the corner of my eye, and I mean, I just said, oh God, please. His health is failing. He's getting older. I've spent 14 years in personal efforts of bridge building, gospel sharing, traveling, doing everything in my power to help him to see his need for you. Please let today be the day. And I was just tormented as I presented the gospel, pleading, you know, and I had people raise their hands. And I got to the point, you know, he's got his arms on there and I'm looking over his way. And his arm comes up and you know what he does? He goes, boom. I almost started bawling. Yeah, 14 freaking years. And he's going like this. I mean, I just want to go back and say, all right, that's too hard on my heart. I just want to come here, sheep, here, sheep. Oh, that's good. You know what I'm saying? Anyway. We just decided, we think the Bible says that churches ought to be about the Great Commission. They ought to try as a church. They ought not to abdicate the evangelistic responsibility to parachurch groups. It ought to happen in and through the local church. So we said, now, if we want to turn irreligious people into fully devoted followers of Christ, how should we do it? And I'm going to take you through the infamous 7-step talk Some of you could give it better than I could, because you've heard it. Others of you, it's brand new. I'll do the best job I can on explaining it. And I want to make my disclaimer at the beginning. We're not taking you through the seven steps so that you say, oh, this is the prescription for our church. This is the strategy for our church. We don't do it with a cloning in mind, with duplicating in mind. We do it for illustration purposes. In a way, what we're saying is, here's how one church, just this church on this hunk of real estate, this is how one church has been led by the Holy Spirit to try to fulfill the Great Commission. This is one strategy. There are hundreds of strategies, many of which will fit you better than this strategy will. But some of you, this will be a dead ringer fit. Some of you can take little parts of it. Others of you can say, well, you know, nice props, you know. Or anyway, okay? So here's what we said. If we're ever going to turn irreligious people into fully devoted followers of Christ, we got to start somewhere. You got a non-church guy, we call him Non-Church Harry, and he's sitting in the subdivision over there. If you look outside, you can see homes across the way. We have people right across the street from Willow Creek. Someone told me they're staying at the Budgetel Hotel, and the staff, they said, we're at a conference at Willow Creek, and they said, what's that? That's about a mile and a half from here, the Budgetel. They don't even know who we are, what we're doing, okay? And let's just say that they also don't know Christ. People all around our church and all around your church don't know Christ, don't listen to Christian radio, don't watch Christian television. They don't read church ads. They don't go to Christian bookstores. I mean, they're outside of the outside of any contact with the gospel. What's going to be the first contact? What's the best way to make the first contact with a non-church person who's headed for a Christless eternity that you'd like to introduce to Christ? What we just say is we're going to put our eggs in the basket of building a relationship, reaching out a hand, building a relationship with non-church people. We're going to challenge every believer in Willow Creek to, with some degree of intentionality, to say, part of what my life is going to be about is to be about to reaching out to someone outside the family of God for the purposes of bridge building in the hopes that someday I can share my faith with them. But to just be Christ, to just be a loving person in their life. This isn't bait and switch stuff. This isn't, I'm going to pretend to be your friend and see if you'll warm up, and if you don't, you're out of here. This is being a loving person. Being a loving person to an unchurched guy or gal. And just including them in your regular relational network where you jog with them. You know, it's an interesting story. The guy who was up on our stage early this morning with the measuring tapes around his neck ready to hang himself, he's in commercial real estate. And he's on our drama team. 15 years ago, he was lost as the geese you see flying around out here, by his own admission. He was so lost and so spiritually confused, he sold out of his business, moved up to the North Woods to live in virtual seclusion to try to figure out the meaning of life. This was one serious seeker. Moves up to the North Woods to like contemplate reality. Doesn't find it up there. Comes back in this area and just goes about his life, says it's all nothingness, I guess. One of the guys in this church sees him running one day. Says, how far do you run? A couple miles a day. You mind if I run with you? They start jogging together. And they start, one thing leads to the next, leads to the next. He winds up sharing his faith with him, inviting him to the seeker service. He gives his life to Christ, and the rest is kingdom history, as they say. And it all started when Dave Eichmann on our staff put his hand out to Ted. He said, can I run with you? That's it. These two gals in the health club, Sharon, you know, saying, can I put out my hand to you? And I'm telling you, friends, for 20 years, I've been going everywhere God would give me an audience, and I've been asking religious leaders, will you put your hand out to somebody? Would you put your hand out to somebody? Something happened in the church a while back where we got on the wrong paradigm. I don't know if it was a misunderstanding of Paul's words when he said, come ye apart and be separate from them. I don't know. But for some reason, we have developed a separatistic theology that I think oversteps the idea of what Paul meant in the passage. I think when Paul said, come ye apart and be separate from them, I think all he meant was lead distinctively Christ-honoring lives. But when Jesus said, be salt and light, I mean, the idea of salt is it has to get up close to that which it's going to affect. The idea of light is you put it in the darkness. Sooner or later, somebody with Christ in his heart has to do what Christ did, which was put his hand out to people without faith and to just be a loving, involved person in their relational network. And I got to tell you, friends, unless something shifts in your heart, and I mean like the big one that they're saying is going to happen out in Southern California, unless the geological plates in your heart shift to where you see that this is one of the most important things your life needs to be about. I think there's dark days ahead for lost people. Because they can shut off Christian radio, television, they can rip bumper stickers, throw them in the trash. I mean, they can take tracts that we hand them and smoke them with stuff in them. You know, I mean, that's... I mean, they're impervious to almost everything. They're impervious to it. But I'll tell you what they're still open to is a hand. They really are. A couple summers ago, I started sailboat racing. I felt that my life was getting too morose, too burdened down by kingdom weightiness and that kind of thing. And the Christian counselor I was going to, he kept saying, Bill, you know, you're going to wreck your life unless you balance some of the heaviness and the responsibility in your life with some recreation and all that kind of stuff. And so eventually I started doing some sailboat racing. And when I was putting a crew together on my boat, I just felt led by God to make up a crew of non-Christian guys in the little town that I vacationed in the summer. And so it was very tempting for me to, you know, get some staff guys from the church, some Christian guys from the town. Because then, you see, we could fellowship together while we raced. We could pray, you know, beat the other boats through the sheer power of prayer, you know. And so I said, no, I just felt prompted, you know, by the Spirit to put a group of non-church guys together. So they all were all fired up. Yeah, boy, we'll be there. So the first night they come, and they're walking down to the boat here, and they got, you know, Big pile, or what are these cases, you know, of Bud Lights and all these things. And you know, like the name of the boat is Blessing, you know, it's supposed to be like a Christian boat. These guys are piling on, you know, and putting the, I said, put it down below. We just put it down below. And then we get out on the starting line, and you know, if you know anything about sailboat racing, it's very intimidating, it's chaotic, and a lot of stuff happens on starting lines. These big boats coming at each other and intimidating each other, and pretty soon, my guys are standing screaming obscenities, you know, at other boats and just turning the air blue. And a lot of guys know who I am, whatever, you know. And I, you know, fellas, you know. And then, you know, later on, we'd be going downwind and things would get settled. And they'd tell some very risque joke. It wasn't risque. I mean, it was way over the line. And I felt guilty because I'd laugh at it. Oh, like you haven't, right? I mean, admit it, some of those are the funniest ones, right? And so, you know, all right. But so there's all of that discomfort. Then they all want to go to the bar afterwards and talk about how we did at the race. And, you know, there's all those discomforts. And, you know, come on, Bill. I mean, this is what everybody does. And so I'm doing this week after week after week. And I did it for a couple of years, actually. same group of guys, did it again this past summer. And one guy out of that crew has given his life to Christ already. He's the guy I referenced this morning, or last night, I guess it was, at the communion service where I said he took his first communion 2 weeks ago. And, you know, I lose my bearings once in a while about what happens in big crowds. But if you say, what was the high point of 1993 for me? It was Tommy giving his life to Christ. I mean, whatever God did, other things, I don't know that much about. I mean, I get screwy on those things. I go, ugh. But that, I know something about. And that was the highlight of 1993. Now, in about a month, a team of us are going to New Zealand to put on a CLC in New Zealand. And four or five board members from Willow Creek are going to meet me in Hawaii when I'm coming back. And Tommy's brother, Terry, who's also been on my crew for the last 2 years, he's going to come with us. We're going to sail for a week around the Hawaiian Islands, and we're going to have five Christian guys and Terry on a sailboat in a confined space for 7 days. And I tell you, we're all praying for Terry. And it's just putting your hand out, just like that, you see. So, you know, you come to a conference like this and you say, boy, I want one of those seeker services. I want all that souped up drama and music. I want those high powered medias. I want all the bells and whistles. I want it all. Friends, seeker services are useless. They are terrible, expensive wastes of time and kingdom resource, unless first you have a core of people in your church who love Christ enough to be sensitive to lost people enough to reach their hands out to a seeker. The reason why our weekend services are so electric around here is because there's several thousand seekers there. I mean, the stuff you saw this morning would be real old and real lifeless if we had a pretty good indication that we were doing that for believers. And where I find, you know how you get a church motivated and inspired to do step one? The senior pastor, senior staff members, key elders, deacons, board members, and lay people have to model this and teach it. If you don't model it and teach it, don't expect anybody else to get on board with it. Forget it. You know, it's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing to be in the middle, you know, just be a regular traditional pastor shining up sheep, keeping them in the pen. There's a ministry there. I don't think it's anywhere near the fully orbed ministry that God would have for you. But I got to say, if you want to carry out the Great Commission, if you want to turn irreligious people into fully devoted followers of Christ, this is where it begins. The senior pastor, in his own personal life, starting to build relationships with non-church guys and senior staff, elders, board, model it and teaching it. Okay? And when you do that, what usually happens is those friendships get formed and then there's all kinds of exciting things that unfold in the relationship, and pretty soon somebody says, that guy or gal that you've built the relationship with, in this case, you know, these gals ride extra cycles next to each other for a real long time. And then there's going to come that point afterwards where this gal is going to say to Sharon, so Sharon, what does it mean to be a Christian? What does it mean? Step two is when someone asks you, when the Holy Spirit gives you that opening, you know, to give a defense for your faith, then train your believers to be able to give a crisp
compelling verbal witness. Our impact evangelism ministry, our new community, our small groups, we try from a lot of different standpoints and coming at it a lot of different ways to train our believers to be able to give a crisp verbal witness to the saving power of Christ. Now, you want to hear a good one. Lee Strobel, who was one of the teaching pastors here and a great friend. Lee Strobel, now let's show you how this works. Lee has come up with a little format that he uses lots of times when he's trying to lead his friends to Christ. So one weekend he taught it to the whole church. And it was for a dual purpose. I mean, all the seekers said, oh, this is how you become a Christian. And all the Christians said, this is how I can explain to someone how to become a Christian. You follow me? So he did it. Out in the crowd, there's a Christian who writes it down on a piece of paper and puts it in his Bible. Okay? Just a good guy in the church. So my friend, my sailing buddy, Tommy, has an opportunity to spend some time with that guy. He's the guy that actually led Tommy to Christ. Okay? So many months later, I had given Tommy a Bible a year prior to that. So we were at a sailing regatta together one time, Tommy and me, this summer as a matter of fact, and he left his Bible by his sailing bag. And mine was downstairs and I wanted to just have my devotion, so I grabbed that Bible I had given Tommy and I opened it up just to read some scriptures. What do you think I find in the Bible? I find a little pencil drawing of what the guy in the church service had learned from Lee Strobel, and that's the little scheme he drew out for Tommy and that Tommy understood and signed his name on and gave his life to Christ. That was the way it worked, you see. That's unbelievable to me, isn't it? I mean, there's a good pastor, Lee Strobel. He's pastoring the sheep saying, if you want to lead your friends to Christ, here's a way you can do it. And here's a really good church member who takes very careful note of it, builds a relationship, and then when the time comes, you know, when Tommy says, well, how do you give your life to Christ? He says, here's how you do it. I tell people all the time, I say, if you would just spend like 2 years, if you would change nothing in your existing churches, okay, if you have sort of traditional settings, if you would change nothing in your services, except by modeling and teaching, do steps 1 and 2. By modeling and teaching, build relationships with non-church people and teach your people how to give a compelling verbal witness. When the window of opportunity opens up, you would see some exciting manifestations of the power of God and changed lives in your church. I guarantee it. That's a biblically backed guarantee. Because people are out there and they're open. They just need a hand and they need some information. But we're not out there inspiring people and modeling for people to put their hand out, and we're not out there teaching and instructing our people how to lead their friends to Christ. If you just concentrate on those two things, oh, I'm telling you, friends, you wouldn't really have to change much. Because the Spirit of God would create the winds of change from that point on. And then I want to say the converse. If you're sitting here saying, I think I hear what he's saying, but I ain't going to do it. Let's get to the souped up stuff. I have another pretty authoritative prediction. You'll launch that souped up seeker service with all the accessories, turbo boosted, shiny, dice hanging from the mirror. You know, I mean, you'll have it all. And after about 6 months or a year, you'll finally awaken to the fact that you're putting all that energy and effort into something and there's no seekers there. And then you'll say, this is not smart. And it'll be a big defeat. It begins when people understand we're trying to turn irreligious people into fully devoted followers. We begin
by loving lost people enough to build relationships with them and then to share Christ with them. Now, I think I'd get shot if I didn't tell my story about when it became clear to me how important it is for people to be able to have one of these compelling ways of explaining Christianity to someone when they ask. You know, the Bible says, always be ready to give a defense for your faith. Be ready, right now, when the opportunity opens itself up. Lynn and I went on a sailing vacation many years ago, and we pulled, a friend of ours has a boat down in the Caribbean, and so he allowed us to use it. So we took it to this beautiful island, Peter Island, down in the Caribbean. Some of you have heard of it. And we pulled into a beautiful crescent-shaped lagoon, palm trees. I mean, it's really idyllic. Dropped the anchor, and then we decided to walk ashore. So we took the little dinghy and we rowed it ashore, pulled it up on the beach. And as we were walking around on the sandy beach there, we bump into a guy, and he said, "Did you just pull in that beautiful sailboat out there?" And we said, "Well, yeah, a friend of ours owns it, and we're using it for a week." And he said, "Well, we chartered the one right next to you out there. A bunch of us from, I think you said, the East Coast, Boston, as I recall." He said, "Want to come over for cocktails later on?" And we said, "Well, you know, we're not big drinkers." He said, "Well, I don't care what you drink. Come on over. We'll have some fun." So he said, "Okay." So when the appointed time came, Lynn and I got in the little dinghy, which is like this, and we rowed over to this great big chartered sailboat. Beautiful yacht. We climbed up a ladder, and he gave us a tour of the... It was a magnificent boat. And then we all went to the back of the boat. There were like six couples, 12 people. Maybe we were number 13 and 14. We're all sitting in the back of the boat under this bimini cover as sort of the sun is going down. Just a wonderful setting. And the drinks started flowing, the pina coladas and all these things. And we're sitting there with our little orange juice. And they're telling stories and having fun and laughing and... I mean, it was just a wonderful thing to be a part of until a woman said, "So, Bill, what do you do for a living?" Now, this is a moment of truth, right? So, with uncharacteristic boldness, you know, I said, "Well, I'm a minister." And apparently they had had enough to drink that didn't even faze them. Because they said, "We got a minister. Oh, isn't that great?" And then they just went on and told their stories and jokes and had fun. And then it became apparent to me that it was almost dinner time. There was a chef down below cooking some stuff. And so I said, "I think we'll excuse ourselves and go back to our own boat." They said, "Oh, stay for dinner." We said, "No, you know, it's kind of like a second honeymoon thing. We'll go over to our own boat." They said, "Oh, have it your way." So they all get up to see us off. They're all standing by the lifeline there, drinks in hand. Lynn climbs down the ladder to get in the dinghy, and I'm climbing down. I got 1 foot in the dinghy, 1 foot on the bottom rung of the ladder, and the woman who had asked me what I did for a living said, "Say, Bill, before you go, I always wanted to ask a Christian how you become one." Oof. And I'm looking at this row of 12, you know, and they're kind of listing, and they got their drinks going like this. And I'm thinking, "Oh, my goodness gracious." Now, just hit the pause button for a second. How many people in your church, if they were in a setting like that, and they had just a minute or two to work with, how many people in your church are trained under your tutelage to be able, in a minute or two, to say, "Here's what Christianity is, and here's how Christ changes human lives"? Are they trained? Do they know what to do in a moment like that? And if I wanted to be nasty, I'd say, you men and women of the cloth, how many of you would know how to take advantage of a moment like that and give a crisp, short, but compelling witness to the transforming power of Christ? See, friends, this is so basic. And we don't want to mess with the basics, do we? We want the shiny stuff. We want the stuff that does things with big crowds and big buildings. And we want stuff that makes us feel big and important and successful and all that. I keep having to say, how do lives change? How does the kingdom advance? One life at a time. It's just one life at a time. Someone stretching their hand out, building a relationship. Someone in the context of the relationship, when that moment of opportunity opens up, where somebody says, here's what it means to be a Christian. So you're saying, well, what did you say? I know what you're thinking. So I said to the woman who had asked me, I said, so, I mean, I repeated the question to buy a little time. You know how I used to do that in school? So I said, so, like, you're asking me what a Christian is. She said, well, yeah. And, you know, in just that nanosecond, I got real sober because I thought this may be the only time between now and Judgment Day that these 12 people hear the gospel. Could be. So the way that the Spirit seemed to prompt me is I said, okay. I said, let me try to explain it to you this way. I spell religion D-O. It's what people who have disappointed God and hit balls outside the foul lines, if you know what I mean. It's what people who know they've disappointed God, it's the things they do to try to regain their standing with God. Religion, I spell D-O, the treadmill of religious activity. They want to do, but after a while, they don't know if they're doing enough. And it gets a little higher pitched and shrill as time goes on. And after a while, you just say, I don't know what the quota is and no one will tell me. So a lot of people who are into religion burn out on it after a while and they just say, forget it. And when I said, so that's religion. I spell it D-O and I'm not into that. You should have heard it. We're not into that either. We're with you. You know? I said, but I think the question you asked me was about Christianity. And I spell Christianity D-O-N-E. See what that is? It's what Jesus Christ, God's Son, has done for us when He died on the cross and took the rap for us. I said, now, when I figured out that my sins and transgressions have been paid for by Christ on the cross, and He makes what He has done on the cross available to me as a free gift of grace, I said, I got to tell you, that changed my heart. It changed my whole orientation toward life, and it changed my eternal destiny. I spell Christianity D-O-N-E. It's changed my life, and, you know, it can change yours. Now, I don't know if that was the best thing to say. But I only had a little bit of time to work with, and it was as clear as I could make it with the restraints I was working under. And, I mean, it was something, right? I don't use that approach every time. There's lots of other approaches that I've used and that are good to use. Sometimes I just tell my own testimony. But the point still is that you got to train people to be ready in that moment. And I know some of you are saying, how did it end up? I wish I could end the story like a traveling evangelist would. You know? And one by one they fell on their knees by the lifeline, threw their drinks over the side, confessed Christ as Savior, and I baptized them in the crystal waters of the lagoon. I wish I could tell the story that way. It didn't happen that way. The way it happened was when I got done, I said, now we're on the other boat there, and if any of you'd like to talk further about it, you know, come on over, blow the horn, do something, we'll get together. I got up the next morning, the boat was gone. No one stopped by. Now, I don't know if I'll see any of them in heaven. I don't know if that prompted anything, if that seed ever took root. I don't know. I do know this, though, that if you train your people to be involved, to build relationships with non-church people, there's going to come those times when those windows of opportunity open up, and you got to be able to train, teach, model, go over ways to share the gospel in crisp, compelling ways so you can take advantage of those moments of truth. Now, apparently, a pastor one time heard
heard me give this illustration somewhere, and he got so fired up about it that he held a conference or was asked to speak at a conference, and supposedly with proper attribution, he told this illustration. Ken Miedema, you know Ken? About Ken Miedema, he's a blind piano player and songwriter, composer, singer. Apparently, he really appreciated that illustration, and then at the end, he came up to the piano and played this song that he made up while he was listening to the illustration that I just gave you. So the pastor caught it on tape, sent it to me, and we'll just play it for you, see how you like it.
Standing on the gangplank, headed for the dinghy. My spouse is waiting and I know it's time to go. And then comes the question, through the happy hour haze, how do I get to be a Christian? She said, I really want to know. Stop for a minute. What am I gonna say? Got just a moment, and it's rapidly fading away. How do I get through those piña coladas? I don't know, but somehow I gotta. So I stand on the gangplank, sunshine on my shoulders. I don't know a stupid thing to say, except don't know much about the explanation. I ain't so good at doctrinal conversation. I'm not so good at the exegesis. I don't know how to fit in all the fancy pieces, but I do know that my hope is new. And if I could share this heart with you, what a wonderful world it would be. Yeah, what a wonderful world it would be. Ooh, what a wonderful it would be.
He's something, isn't he? So, all right, so again, you know, I spent a lot of time, some of you are clock watching, don't worry. It is so important that you understand steps 1 and 2, because the rest of them flow out of it. And if you have steps 1 and 2 going, you can get you can be as flexible and creative from this point on, and it doesn't even matter that much. You're going to have a lot of great things, signs and wonders, if you will. The signs and wonders, what are the biggest signs and wonders? Are they healings? Are they tongues? The biggest sign and wonder miracle that you're looking for is salvation of lost souls. I mean, what is bigger? Huh? What's bigger? I'm all for, believe me, when God touches a limb or a back or heals a disease, that's a wonderful miracle. But the person's going to die. I mean, putting it crudely, it's a temporary fix, because you're going to. This isn't coming out right. It's a wonderful thing when a body is healed. It's even more wonderful when a soul is redeemed. Right? Now, we lose sight of that sometimes. And so the signs and wonders, when people say, you know, we get people from some camps and they say, so tell us about signs and wonders. I said, well, we baptized 500 or 600 people last year, you know, like new converts and people whose lives were changed, destinies changed. I think every one of them was a miracle, you know. And I can see sometimes they're disappointed. Yeah, but I mean, we want the hot rod stuff. Well, to me, that is the hot rod stuff. So anyway, when you get steps 1 and 2 going, you can flex all over the place. And step 3 for us is the seeker service, where we just say, look, if we're building relationships with somebody, if we're sharing our faith with them, Some of them will fall on their knees and receive Christ right on the spot. A lot of them are going to say, I'm not ready to fall on my knees and profess Christ. Where can I go to learn more? And if all you have to say is, well, we have this believer service, which is for the already convinced, and you're not going to understand the lingo, understand the music, or be able to hang with the teaching, but you're welcome. Huh? Wouldn't you like to be able to say, there's a place for you. There's a seeker service for you. And you can come. It's an open environment. You don't have to say anything, sign anything, sing anything, or give anything. You can sit in the back row, keep your sunglasses on. Nobody's going to strong arm you. No one's going to embarrass you. What happens on stage will be high quality. It will be relevant to your life. It'll be creative. It'll be practical. It'll be biblical. And it'll be dangerous for your spiritual health. I mean, it will be. It'll be dangerous. But it's designed for you. And it's still at least once a month. Someone will stop down in the bullpen afterwards and someone brand new to the church, they'll shake my hand and they'll say, I haven't been to church in a long time. This church was meant for someone like me. Now, little does he know. You know, we've broken our backs to try to evoke that response. Recently, I had a short conversation with a very high-powered attorney from downtown Chicago who's in the seeking process. He's right here, right now. Comes virtually every weekend. And so I had a brief conversation with him just a short time ago. And I said, so how's it going? He knows that I'm on. And I said, so where are the missing pieces? And he could articulate very clearly to me the missing pieces for him yet. And he's on them. I mean, he's researching. He's working with Lee Strobel, getting some questions answered and so. But he says, you know, almost every week another piece fits into place. And that's, you know, the seeker service. Now, what we keep saying is you don't have to do one of these things every week. You could do it every other week, once a month, once a quarter, three times a year. You could do it around special events. That's Holy Spirit stuff, whenever you want to. But I will argue till the day I die that if you don't create an event like that once in a while, then you, when you're talking about evangelism to your church, I think mostly your church just thinks you're blowing smoke. See, when you announce a seeker service, let's say you decide you're going to do one once a month. When you say, what month are we in here? Are we in October? Okay. When you say, just reality check for your sake. You say, all right, this is October, around the middle of the month. November 20, just choosing a date. Okay, church, you pretend you're my church now and you're all believers. Okay, church, November 20, we're going to have a seeker event. I'm going to have three guys there. I'm hoping for five, but I'm going to guarantee that three are going to be there. Okay? How many of you will make a pact with me, trusting God, that you'll be able, through your contacts, when you jog, when you're out in the neighborhood, where you're, you know, all this stuff, at work, how many of you make a pact with me that you'll try to get one seeker there? And how many of you will join me in prayer that when we have that event, that God will show up in power? And through the event that we put on and through the prayer that happens that undergirds it, you know, how many of you will pray and join hands with me and let's try to take some territory back from the evil one? How about it? See? Now, when you do that, what have you done? You've drawn a line in the dirt and you said, I mean business. It's very convenient to say at the end of a service, now go out and have an impact in your world. What is that? People go, okay. Right? Okay. And the next week, did you have an impact in your world? Uh-huh. Trust me. Okay. And then you ought to ask the pastor, did you have an impact in your world? Oh, yes. He'll use his God voice. Yes. You know? You know, Lay not thine hand against God's anointed is the message there. See? And it's a lot of it's just blowing smoke. That's all it is. But I'll tell you, when you say November 20, we're going to have a seeker event. It's exciting. Because everybody's pulling together. Everyone's working together. People are taking risks. People are making phone calls. And you know what we have out in our lobby here, main lobby, we have what we call the fool's bench. Have I ever talked to you about that? The fool's bench? And this is an unbelievable thing. I hope I can get through it and keep my emotions under control. But I got a letter from a guy one time, and he said, we had a special outreach event. The whole church was praying for months before it. And, you know, we had tickets to hand out to people, and we were really praying that God would break through in people's lives. And so the guy writes me this letter. And he said, Bill, you should have seen what happened in the lobby last Saturday night. He said, there are a whole bunch of us who were out there. We'd handed out tickets to our seeking friends that we'd built relationships with and witnessed to and who had promised that they were going to show. And so the deal was going to start at 8 o'clock, and at 1:45, boy, we were out there. We were walking around in the lobby. And every time the door would open, we'd say, is it my friend? Oh, no, it's not. Is it my friend? Is that? Oh, no, it's not. And he said every once in a while, someone who was hanging around by the benches out there, so their friend would come in. Oh, I'm so glad you came. And they'd come in and find their seats. And he said, but there was a group of us. He said, our friends never showed. So when the program started, we all just sat down on the bench around the flower thing out there. And we were all sad. And he said, it just reminded me of the passage in 1 Corinthians 1 where it says, I guess you got to be willing to be a fool for Christ. He said, we looked at each other like a bunch of losers. Like we had thrown a party and people who said they were going to come wouldn't show. Bunch of losers. And he said, but I guess you got to be willing to be, huh? And ever since that, I mean, it's kind of common lingo around here. I mean, everyone knows where the fool's benches are. And you see it every weekend. People looking for their friends. You know? You got that going on. That's heart. Isn't it? That's heart. That's a sign and a wonder in and of itself, if you ask me. And I can relate to it. One of my friends who's not a Christian yet, but who comes here regularly, he called me, I don't know, on a Friday. He said, can I sit with you down in the bullpen? He said, I'm going to be there. And I said, sure, I'd love to have you down there. So, man, I mean, I don't know in the last year if I've ever prayed harder for a particular message because I thought he was at the point where he might cross the line. And like an hour before I left to come over for the Saturday night service, he calls, leaves a message on my answering machine. He says, something came up I can't show. I don't know why it hit me so hard, but I just thought, how many more of these can my heart take? You know? It's you gotta, I don't know if I'm doing a good job describing it, but it's hard. It's hard to put your heart out and your hand out and your prayers out and then to take the hits. But that's part of it, you see. And when you announce these seeker events, you get fool's bench stuff. You get people who come and their friends trust Christ. Whether you do it weekly, monthly, doesn't matter. But I really believe you ought to have events like this once in a while. And it serves notice. It fires everybody up. It focuses the church. It releases, you know, some evangelistic pent-up energy. I think it's really healthy for a church. We do it every weekend because we never want our believers to be more than 7 days away from an opportunity to bring a friend, you know, to a seeker event. That's just us. But again, that's not for everybody. And you saw, you know, the front half of the seeker service. Let me just say one word about preaching at the seeker service. And Nancy would say this. We didn't talk about it much this morning. The single most important ingredient at the seeker service by a factor of about 3 is the preaching. And if you kid yourself otherwise, you really are just kidding yourself.
We say it this way. If the first half hour is fantastic, but if the message isn't really anointed or relevant or prayed up or effective, people will walk out, seekers will walk out and they'll say, I don't think I'm coming back. And then you can have one of those Murphy Law Sundays where like vocalists forget their words, chords fall out of microphones, drama props fall over, ceiling tiles cave in, lights come off, feedback from the system. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? And I mean, it's like one wreck after the next. Wreck. Like that. And then the guy gets up and he gives a message that's anointed. And seekers walk out and they say, I will come back next week. A team of wild horses couldn't keep me away. It's the message, friends. It's always been the message. Scripture says it's the message. Church history tells us the message. It's always the message. So it is so very important that people with the right preaching and speaking gifts are anointed in the right positions, time to prepare and all that. We'll talk more about preaching later. Okay, usually it's the combination of the first three steps right about here where someone gives their life to Christ. And obviously, that's the angels in heaven rejoice over that, and so do we. The next step, the fourth step, is our believer service. Just shows here the, you know, all the people coming together. Our believer service services happen on Wednesday and Thursday night. And they're worship services, they're exaltation services, they're teaching services. It's when our body gathers, Wednesday and Thursday nights. Many of you were there last night. That was a typical communion service. Now, usually we would worship for 40 minutes, 45 minutes, and then we would teach expositorily for 40 minutes or so. But on communion nights, we've decided we want to give communion its proper weight, and so we've decided most of the time not to have a message on communion nights, but all the rest of them we do. And this is where we want people to deepen their Christian experience, learn how to worship, learn how to pray, learn more about the Bible, come together as the church, receive nurture and care. Tomorrow morning, we'll actually put on a worship service, not as a fake run-through deal. We'll just invite you to worship with us and talk about it a little bit. But this is very, very critical. And if I could just talk raw church philosophy for a second. Do you know why a lot of Christians aren't doing steps 1-2 and inviting people to a seeker event? It's because they don't get filled up enough. They don't get edified enough. They don't get built into and nurtured, cared for, trained up, motivated enough at your believer service to want to do steps 1, 2, and 3. Really. Somebody has to be filled to overflowing before they're going to reach out a hand to a pagan. You got to have a reason to, don't you? If they're not filled up enough with Christ, they're not going to reach out their hand. If they don't reach out their hand, then the whole seven-step thing, it just falls apart. And so we put enormous energy into our Wednesday and Thursday night new communities because that's where we fill people up. That's where we try to equip and train and inspire and motivate and comfort and all of that. That happens step 4. Step 5, small groups. Some of you are at the Next Step seminars where we talked about small groups. We may do a change in the CLC. I think what's going to happen in the future is I want to give a general session about small groups. I think we'll be heading toward that in future months or years. Friends, this is quite a small group. They're levitating. I mean, there's such power in their community. Ones that I'm in are firmly anchored to planet Earth, I assure you. But this is something. But you really learn in church work to distrust what happens in large groups. Life change
Life change happens best, happens most frequently in the context of a small group. I think you've learned that already, haven't you? I mean, you've experienced that. I can't tell you how many times important crossroads, I mean, I've come to important crossroads in my life, and boy, which way I was going to go, one way or the other, was determined by who I was hanging with at the time. Who was building into me? Who had access to my heart? Who got up close to me and said, "Oh, Bill, don't do that," or "You ought to be doing that." This is so important. Let me just free associate here about the importance of small groups for a second, then I'll get into the mechanics of it. A pastor whose name you would recognize, and I'm not playing games, I just want to protect him, but a really good pastor, told me a while back, this goes back quite a few years, but he said he got to a point of complete exhaustion in his life. So a couple of really close brothers that he was in a small group with, you know, said to this guy, "You need a break. I mean, you need at least 6 weeks off, and you need it now. So pack up your stuff and get out. Tell the elders of the church you got to get out for a while because you're in trouble. We know you. We love you. You got to get out." So the pastor goes, okay. And they said, "Now you're going to do it? You're going to walk into the elders? You're going to do it?" They said, I'll do it. So he walks into the elders meeting, and five out of six of them agree. And the sixth guy sat there with his arms crossed, and he said, "I've been in my job for 30 years and have never gotten a six-week break. I say you stay and tough it out like the rest of us have to." So this pastor, you know, he says to himself, "Well, here's my tight-knit group of brothers who are counseling me one way. But here's an elder of the church who's thinking, I better not do this." What do you think he did? He rolled up his sleeves, tried to be heroic, and he hung in there and kept going. The rest is kingdom tragedy. He blew his life apart about 2 months later and has never completely recuperated. He should have just hung with the brothers who knew and loved him. I mean, people who know you well, people who really are close to you, I mean, those are the ones whose counsel really is important, right? And we all need to have situations and people around us like that. I got one of these letters that all pastors hate to get recently. I mean, the kind where someone who knows you pretty well and has some access to your heart writes one of those letter bombs that go off in your heart. And I had one of those come. I don't get that many of them. I get, you know, some little firecrackers now and then. But this one was a letter bomb. And I read it. It was at the absolute worst time I could have my heart broken. And, I mean, it's a long story, but I was almost inconsolable when I got that letter. So I call a guy that I've walked with for about 15 years. And it's very hard for a prideful person to do. So I call this guy. I said, "Rich, I need your help. I just need somebody to encourage me. I felt like a jerk. I just need someone to encourage me, you know." A little while later, he's in my office. And he's walking around and pumping me up and saying, "Give me that letter. I'll rip that thing up into confetti right here. Give me that letter, you know. It may be true. I don't care. It shouldn't have been said like that." Like that. And he's all pumped up. And he said, "You're not perfect, Bill, but you're forgiven. And God's in you. And I believe in you." And then he must have called the other guy that, another guy that I've walked with for a long time, because the next morning, like 6:30 in the morning, there's a knock on my study door at the office here. It's another guy from the group that I run with. He comes in and he sits down. He slides a manila envelope across the desk. In it is about a four-line note on his company's stationery. He's being real formal about it. And the essence of the letter is, "I don't care what anybody says. I love you. And I wanted you to read it from me today." You know, it's pretty good. So that's right on the side of my, that's bottom right-hand drawer, right on top. You know,
Life is hard. Disappointments hit all of us. There's train wrecks that happen all the time, and church leaders aren't spared from them. I came home from a Saturday night service a year and a half ago. My wife learned some information that wiped her out. I tried to console her for a while, and it became very apparent that I wasn't adequate for the job. And I said, "Do you think we should call this other couple that we relate closely to?" I said, "Do you think we ought to call so-and-so?" She said, "I think so." So it's 10:30, quarter to 11 at night. I called down their house. "We need some help." "No problem. They're over to our house in 15 minutes. We get down on the study floor together and we talk all about it and we pray and we encourage. And then it's different. And then there's hope regenerated, and then you're not on the floor anymore, you see. Incidentally, 6 or 7 months later, that couple calls us late one night and says, "Help." We said, "Ah, fix yourself. What are you, come on, you know, babies." No. We said, "When and where? You know, when and where?" Got together right away. Now it was our turn to be strong. They were a little weak, see? But Jesus had a small group. Paul had a small group. Throughout church history, the gospel has been propagated and faith has stayed aflame in the lives of people who banded together in small groups. And we've learned the hard way, you know, I don't know if you're aware of it, but we are in a very painful transition right now as a church. And it's cost us some. You know how we go to great pains to say, now if you're going to transition your church from one type to another, you're going to pay a price? Well, we've transitioned our church, the entire infrastructure of our church. And nobody even felt, very few people even felt it ought to be messed with. I mean, the worst kind of change is when you got a lot of people saying, "It's not broke, don't fix it." You know what I'm saying? I mean, when everything's falling apart, then anybody will say, "Yeah, well, let's try anything." But most people, I think, thought we were cruising at a good altitude. And some of us felt very strongly that there were signs of some cracks in the concrete that we needed to pay attention to. And you know what the signs were? In every kind of infrastructure we've had from the beginning days of the church, every time we had a good lay leader who would shepherd some people, if he did it effectively, it set him up to be killed for it. You know what I'm saying? Like when we first started the church, we said, "All right, we're going to have modules. We're going to have lay leaders, two couples, and then we'll make them into shepherding groups." So you take four couples and say, "Now you shepherd these 20 or 30 people." And they really did. And then the group of 20 and 30 became 40 and 50 and 70, 80 and 120 and 140. And then I learned there's four dead people out on the patio. I go, "God, they're dead. What happened?" Well, they tried to keep their job up, their marriages up, they tried to raise their kids and mow their lawns, and they tried to shepherd 140 people. Golly. And then about 30 or 40 lay people were walking around mad saying, "I thought you said that if we joined a group, we'd feel cared for." I said, "They gave their lives for you." No, we still didn't feel cared for. Okay. Well, we'll change infrastructure. So we'll run at a little different approach. And we have tried all kinds of different approaches. But like every time we tried to get the spans of care about where they needed to be, if lay leaders did a good job, their deal grew until it killed them. And after, 16 years of carnage, Jim Dethmer, who was with us for 3 years, he's taking a season off of ministry right now. We hope he'll be back, but that's for God to decide. But Jim and I just sat down, and Jim just said, "Bill, there is a way There is a way that we could, you know, redo the entire infrastructure of the church. It's going to be costly. I mean, it's going to rattle a lot of cages, but we could have discipling groups, we could have serving groups, community groups, seeker small groups. There could be appropriate spans of care. There could be apprentice leaders. There could be coaches. There could be divisional leaders. There could be care and training through the whole system. And every time a group starts, it has an apprentice leader in it, so that if the group is successful, it will give birth to another group, which also will have an apprentice leader. There will never be inappropriate spans of care. Leaders will always be in training. It'll always be growing if we kind of follow this system. And we've put enormous resource, time, and energy behind it. Three weekends ago, at a resort 45 minutes from here, we had 1,200 small group leaders in a room with their hands up in the air saying, God, use me to shepherd people. And point me to the hill because we're going to take it. And we have more people in small groups now, more small group leaders, better spans of care than ever in the history of the church, and a way of going about it now that has the seeds of life in it instead of the seeds of death. But it has been very difficult for us. Some people have got mad and left. Some staff have said, we don't like church that way. That's hard. But, you know, as leaders, sometimes you say, these are tough calls that have to be made. And we've made some tough ones. And what we're seeing now is, you know, we had a lot of people. Hey, John, I got to ask you, what time does this session end? It ended? Oh. I thought it was 3:30. I really did. My fault. I know. You don't have to rub it in. Yeah, I'll finish. Get a drink. Get a drink. Oh. No, I forgot where I was. I was talking about small groups, right? Oh, here. There's a lot of tasks that have to be done in a church. So I'll just use a task for illustration purposes. We do a lot with seeds tapes of all of our services. So we'd have, let's say, 8 people, volunteers who would come at different times, and they'd run off tapes in our seeds tape department. So they'd take time out of their busy schedule, come over here, stand at tape machines, copy off a couple thousand, couple hundred, I don't know how the scale of numbers there, but lots of tapes, and then they'd leave, never really having touched relationally with anybody. Now we have what we call serving groups, which means of the eight people who are doing tapes, one of them's a leader, then there's an apprentice leader in the group. When they come together, before they just run up and start running off tapes, they just sit in a little circle, say, how's it going? What are you learning? How's your wife? How's the kids? Anything you want us to pray about? Because we'd like to just have a little community before we go up and punch out tapes. And so there's fellowship that happens. People are connected. There's a sense of community. Then when they stand there doing tapes, they say, oh man, I really appreciated what you said. And they're done doing tapes. Instead of flying off at home in different directions, they say, why don't we go out in the atrium, have a cup of coffee, and talk about what you said about in the little share time there. You see what I'm saying? We brought community to service. And we're learning a lot about that stuff. You know, when someone signs up for a volunteer position in your church, you know what we want as church leaders? We want them to do the job. Because there's a lot of jobs that have to be done. You know what most of the time motivates a layperson to sign up to do something at the church? They want fellowship. They want fellowship. So we're saying, come, mow this acre and a half of grass, and go. The guys out there, this is great. You know, this is great. I mow my own, I mow theirs, this is great. Now what we say, all you who mow, before you climb on the mowers, you know, let's sit down. How you doing? What's going on? Don't start the mower yet. Get your hands off the mower. Just sit here. And after a while, you know, people really love to mow because they get the richest fellowship of their week before and after they mow. You see what I'm saying? So we have all different kinds of small groups, but I'll tell you, this is going to be big because society has changed, and without community, without churches offering rich community, There's a lot of loneliness in the world and in the church. The next step is fingerprint spiritual gifts. There's seminars on this. What we say is, instead of just sticking people in open positions, saying, you look warm and willing, teach fourth grade. He gets down in the fourth grade class and these kids say, what's this guy doing here? He doesn't like kids. He doesn't know how to teach. I said, well, he was warm and willing. Yeah, well, have him teach the eighth graders. We want someone who likes to teach, who likes kids. Right? Well, what we say is, let's not start with an open position. Let's start with a person and say, how did God gift you? How did He impassion you? That's our whole network ministry, where we help people understand their spiritual gifts and help them find a place to use them in the church. And then the final step is stewardship. And you say, why isn't there a big wallet there then? For the simple reason that really very few churches actually have wallet problems. They have heart problems. Because where your heart is where your treasure is. Where your treasure is, there your heart is. What someone's heart is fired up about, someone's wallet will support. And what we do is we just go for the hearts of people and love them. Fill them up, love them, fill them up, love them, fill them up. And then when it comes time to meet the needs of the church, we say, we've got some needs that we want people whose hearts are full of grace to address. I think we may be the only mega church in the United States, maybe North America, that has never used professional fundraisers. Hope we never will have to. We're within, I think, 16 months of being entirely debt-free, the whole campus. I just say that to God be the glory, but I think in part it's been because we have just focused on the hearts of people, taught stewardship principles, we don't have a pledge system. Not that any of those things are bad. In fact, right now we're behind budget a little bit, and I'm thinking of handing out some envelopes with numbers and names on them. But no, not really. There's reasons for that. But there's really heart issues at stake when it comes to stewardship. And I know. So if you scan all the way across, if you're trying to turn irreligious people into fully devoted followers, then you take non-church Harry, you build a relationship with them, witness to them, seeker event, church, get him in a small group, help him find his spiritual gift. He becomes a steward. He's pretty close to being a fully devoted follower at that point. Then you say, hey, you, go find someone else who is like you and do the same.